If you used a touchscreen, an automated door opener, or an automated faucet today, it's probably based on the technology of inventor and entrepreneur Hal Philip. We continue our conversation today with Hal Philip on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
What does it take to bring a creative idea from conception to market? We find out next as we continue to talk to inventor and entrepreneur Hal Philip, whose technology has been licensed by companies such as Ford, Electrolux, GE, and Apple. And we're going to talk today especially how Apple and Hal Philip came head-to-head in a patent conflict. This is the fourth installment of this podcast. If you haven't listened to the previous three, I encourage you to do so because you'll get a better foundation about what we're talking about. Among other things, Hal Philip made the touchscreen cheap and robust. Now, Hal, the majority of touchscreens in the world use your technology, right?
Yes.
Have you ever estimated how many touchscreens there are?
No. Billions and billions, Bob. Billions and billions.
Where did that come from? That's Carl Sagan.
Sagan.
Billions. Yeah, exactly. And what do you think? Do you have a sense of pride when you look at these all of these different touchscreens and say, hey, I did that?
I have mixed emotions, honestly, Bob. I mean, part of me is very proud of what I did, and it's really something, I guess, to talk about. But on the other hand, well, you know, I helped create a planet full of zombies.
A planet full of zombies. Yes. Everybody sits around the dinner table and everybody's on their phone. And
nobody's talking to each other
anymore. And you're responsible for that.
They're texting each other while they're sitting next to each other.
I actually did that. I was at a meeting one time, and this was, I guess it was with touchscreen, but I was sitting on the other side of the room of a friend of mine named Mohammed El Shikari, and he was next to the donuts. So I texted him and I said, please bring me a donut. And so on the other side of the room. So he got up and just to embarrass me, he bought the whole big box of donuts over and put it in front of me. And then we learned later that way. So yeah, you're right. This sort of a stuff does get abused. But there is quite a story in the implementation of touchscreen and the battles that you waged. We talked about last time of you being copied by an MIT professor, a contractor, a military contractor, and other people. But the big one was indirectly associated with Apple Computer. Mm. And this started with something called Fingerworks. Is that right?
Yep. Well, my relationship with Apple started in about 2000 when they approached me for a license on my technology for a power button on the G4 Power Cube.
Now, it was a little cube. It was early. What year was it?
2000.
So it was a little cube. And they wanted your technology in the cube.
Yeah, you can look it up on Wikipedia. The G4 was a cubic-shaped computer with a radiator sticking out of the top and or a vent sticking out of the top. And it had a capacitive touch button that they developed themselves so to replace the mechanical button for on-off. And it didn't work at all very well. And they were looking around for a replacement circuit, and they came upon my technology and bought one of my chips, stuck it in, liked it a lot, and then they started talking to me and my company about licensing. And that was in the 2001 timeframe. The G4 was discontinued, but the engineering efforts went over to a different group that made monitors. So we dealt with them on monitors, and that's where the licensing took place.
Okay.
With a monitor group for a power button and a menu button on the same monitor. So there were two chips involved.
Okay, so you actually had a very nice technology agreement with Apple.
Yes, involving royalties.
Okay, but then things got kind of sour. Steve Jobs is very known for being aggressive. And I think we mentioned in a previous podcast how some of the larger companies really don't care about the rights and technical contributions of others. They just bulldoze ahead, recognizing that if they infringe on a patent, well, they'll either settle with the people, maybe drown them in court with lawyers' fees, or end up buying up the company. And you had such a situation develop later, right?
Oh, yes. So, the relationship had unfortunately soured with Apple fairly early on because I refused to sign their terms and conditions. And the terms and conditions of Apple were that I would never sell to one of their competition. And course, for a small company, that was very untenable. And so I refused to sign. I think I know that one of the mid-level managers there got fired over that. Rolling forward, the license agreement still was in place, and we were getting money from this license agreement from Apple. And we kept presenting them with other things that we were developing, including touchscreen. And about in late 2004, we had a meeting with a bunch of managers and engineers and Johnny Ive at Apple.
Johnny
Ive is the design engineer, head of design, English guy. He's described in the book on the biography of Steve Jobs. But so we had a big meeting, and we described and showed the touch technology at that time for capacitive screens. And then we didn't hear from them anymore, and it sort of went silent. And we found out later through a third party that Apple was using my technology in various applications. For example, the trackpad on the notebook, the Mighty Mouse, as they called it at the time, had one of my sensors in it, and also the rotary wheel on the iPod. So the capacitive version of that.
Well, let's back up a little bit, because I know with FingerWorks there was an early connection.
Yes.
And what was FingerWorks?
Well, I didn't find out about that until later.
But FingerWorks, you didn't? Okay.
FingerWorks was a company based in Delaware. It was started and run by two professors from the University of Delaware. And without naming them, they had developed a capacitive technology for use on keyboards to turn a whole keyboard into a mouse surface. Unfortunately, I had done that back in the mid-90s and had filed for patents on that. And unfortunately, they also were using my capacitive sensing technology to accomplish this. But I didn't know. I didn't know about FingerWorks until quite late in the game. But also, I was not aware that FingerWorks was also working on supplying Apple with this technology. And so Apple was maybe wittingly, maybe unwittingly, I don't know, I suspect it was wittingly, was using my patented technology through the conduit of FingerWorks through their consulting and manufacturing activities. They were supplying a chip, I think, to Apple at that time. And this all broke out into the open when I talked to a third party who published an app note on their website, which described my technology perfectly.
Was this describing the technology at FingerWorks?
Yes, it was describing the technology at FingerWorks and mine, because it started mm-hmm. with mine. Of course, it was really my technology.
Yeah.
And this company was Cypress Semiconductor in the Bay Area. And so they had published an app note, and I went out and talked to them, and they actually pulled the app note away from their website.
But so they did the right thing.
They did the right thing initially, but they were still in a contractual relationship with Apple to supply chips, using the software that was apparently provided by these two gentlemen from FingerWorks in Delaware. At least that's, I don't have absolute proof of how this relationship took place or what exactly happened, but that was my understanding. So, and then of course we sent a letter to a cease and desist cut type of letter to FingerWorks
mm-hmm.
because they were clearly violating my patents and also to Apple and also to Cypress. And the result was within a few weeks, FingerWorks went out of business. Their website put up a big notice saying we're no longer in operation. FingerWorks is gone.
Hal and I just looked on the Wayback Machine, and they had, we looked at the webpage of FingerWorks, and yep, there it was. FingerWorks is no longer doing business, period.
Cease to operate.
Yeah. Cease to operate was the terminology.
And they left a lot of customers in the lurch. They actually had loyal customers for this technology. Apparently, their product was pretty good, because if you look at the comments from their users, they liked it.
So clearly,
but suddenly, there was no support, no nothing, no warranty service, nothing.
So your cease and desist letter kind of scared them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. That's the only way that you can, the only thing you can possibly conclude.
Right.
And through the lawsuit with Apple, we found out through depositions later that FingerWorks, actually the two professors involved there had been subsumed or contracted with by Apple, so they were now Apple employees.
Really?
Yes.
Do you think they did that to get it under the Apple legal team? I guess the only thing you can do is guess, but
seems
like that would be a wise move.
Yeah, it protected these two professors, clearly, because I couldn't really sue them personally. It was a suit against their company, and the company just ceased to exist. It vaporized.
Uh-huh.
And so now they were under the protection or the umbrella of Apple, and continuing to do what they were doing with Apple, even though Apple knew full well they were in violation. They and the FingerWorks guys were in violation of my patents.
Wow. So you were informed when the iPod came out that they were that iPod was violating your patent. Do you remember who told you that?
Yeah, those were the Cypress guys, Cypress Semiconductor.
Oh, they told
you. So we had a very candid conversation with them, and their executives told me in no uncertain terms where the stuff came from.
Okay.
And that they had a contractual relationship with Apple to supply chips. But the chips were being, the chips that Cypress was making were kind of generic, like programmable logic array type chips with a microprocessor built into them. And apparently what these two professors had done was incorporate code into these chips so that they performed the function described in my patents. And for Apple's benefit, for use in trackpads and for the scroll wheel and the iPod and so on. So that was where this came about, where we got the understanding from.
Did you purchase an iPod and kind of inverse engineer?
Yes, we did. We looked at all that stuff, and it was really 100% clear it was in violation.
Wow.
And so we sued Apple in 2006, and that's a whole other podcast probably.
Okay. So let's see. Your patent, I think, that they infringed was made in 98. At least one of them.
That sounds right, yeah.
There were actually, I think, three patents?
Five. We just looked at the paperwork here,
and
there were five patents that were cited that they were potentially in violation of.
And so one of the patents was 98. The iPod was introduced in 2001.
Yes, but that was about the mechanical wheel. So they started with a mechanical scroll wheel and then quickly moved over to a capacitive wheel. The first iteration of that was not in violation. So, as I said before in one of the other podcasts, that capacitive sensing is not my creation. I take no credit for that. It goes back far earlier in the last century, 1920s. So, it's not about that. It's about making one that actually works well and is efficient and cost-effective. So, what they were using was one from another capacitive sensing company that did trackpads called Synaptics. So, Apple was using the Synaptics technology, which was very expensive, by the way, in the iPod initially. Initially it was the mechanical, and then the first iteration of capacitive was with Synaptics, and then the next iteration was with my technology under the guise of the stuff from the University of Delaware guys and Cypress Semi.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, I know that patent litigation. I've worked as an expert witness a few times for patent litigation. And it can become ugly as lawyers talk to lawyers, as the legal bills mount up, and hopefully you make some sort of progress. But while this lawsuit was going on, you had something called a Markman hearing. What's a Markman
hearing? Yeah, Markman hearing is a decision process about the claims in a particular patent, and the opposition in the case will try to knock out as many claims as possible to invalidate the patent. So I don't know the exact history of Markman hearings, but the general thrust of it is that the court is trying to get clarification of what are valid claims in the patent, and that's an oppositional type process by between the plaintiff and the defendant. And the defendant, of course, is trying to knock out as many claims as they can.
Shouldn't this be something that's fleshed out by the patent office when they grant the patent?
Well, they should, of course, but patent examiners are only human, and they have a huge overload in their in-basket, so they rush through these things typically, and so it remains for the courts to actually determine what is valid and what is not. But the courts can only subtract from a patent, as far as I understand. They cannot add to the claims of a patent. So you're limited by the claims of the patent that you file and are granted, but then later on, some of these claims can be knocked out through this Markman hearing process.
Wow. Okay.
And by the way, you can end up with nothing. It's a very dangerous process.
Oh, is it really?
Because they can knock out your whole patent. Absolutely, it happens.
So that's the reason good lawyers cost a lot, because they're the ones that can come in and make arguments.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, it could be from something that was done 50 years ago, and you just never heard of it. Prior art, you know, somebody did the same thing a long time ago.
I was sharing.
And it impacts your claims, you know?
Yeah. I was sharing with Hal that when I was an expert witness, I learned a new word, which was construe. I knew what it meant, but I never heard it used as much. They would look at a claim and they would say, can you construe this claim as meaning such and such?
Sure.
Which was, they were trying to hedge on the words. And it's all a fight against meanings of words and things.
It is. It's semantics and attack strategies.
You know, I remember at the time when you were going through this, and I looked at some of the press releases, including statements from you during the lawsuit, and you were specifically nice there are a lot of lawsuits where people come head to head and they get kind of nasty towards each other. But at least in one of the accounts I read, you said, look, we have nothing against Apple. We use Apple at Quantum Research. Mm-hmm. We love their computers. It's just that they have used our technology without paying royalties, which are appropriate. So why were you so nice?
Well, I genuinely liked Apple products.
Okay.
And fundamentally, Apple kind of did me a favor in a backhanded sense, because by using the technology, they validated it.
Oh, okay.
So you have to look at it from that perspective. Once everybody understood that this was really my technology that Apple was using, everybody else in the industry came to me. So I had Nokia knocking on my door, Motorola, Samsung, LG, Sony Ericsson, all these guys came to us saying, well, we know what's in these Apple products. We want that too.
Is that right?
So okay. It was a boon for the company. It's a negative in that we had to instigate the lawsuit and pay all the money.
Yeah.
I think in 2007 alone, we were paying $3 million a year.
Holy
just in that year, I'm sorry, okay. Just for litigation on patent issues.
So. Uh-huh.
It was a very expensive proposition for a small company to undertake. But it's a big boy's game. You know, if you're going to be doing patents and licensing and be in the intellectual property space, there are a lot of legal bills to cover. And they can come out of left field. It just hits you blindsided. You have no idea what's going to happen in the future.
Wow.
Or tomorrow. You know.
So this, again, addresses the point that was made, I think, in the first broadcast, that if you get a patent, you all of a sudden don't have all your rights protected. You have to defend it, and it costs big bucks to protect it.
It costs really big bucks to protect it. And big corporates will try to smash you with legal fees.
Yes.
They'll make it a very expensive process. Especially if they know that you're right and that they really are violating, they'll try to raise the legal expenses as high as possible through appeals, through dilatory actions and depositions and requests for discovery and all kinds of mechanisms. They'll raise the cost as high as possible to try to bankrupt you. And that's just a normal strategy, you know. If you're a big corporate and you want something bad enough and you don't want to pay the price, you just go through those motions. It's a lot cheaper than paying honest money for it.
That's a little bit chilling when your bottom line is profit. Your bottom line is your bottom line, I guess.
Well, when you're a small business, it's your livelihood. And also the livelihood of all your employees. You have a responsibility to everybody in your organization.
And you would not have been able to fight this had you been at the beginning of your company.
No, there's no way. No, we didn't have that kind of money. But towards the end, before I sold the company, which is probably a future podcast, we had cash in the bank. We were doing very, very well. We were very solvent. We had no debt problems whatsoever. In fact, we had no debt. So it wasn't a problem to fund the litigation. But on the other hand, another company in a lesser situation would have probably gone bankrupt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you end up licensing to these other companies that knocked on your door, like Samsung?
Yes. Yeah. One of the first big licenses, in fact, was to Motorola.
Really?
For phones. Yeah. For handsets.
Okay.
Yeah. But we did also knock on the door of Nokia, and we had a continual dialogue with them dating back to about 2001, I think. Nokia never took it up, strangely enough. That's another conversation, another podcast.
Okay. Well, we'll give the Reader's Digest version here.
Sure.
You mentioned that you had the Markman hearing, and then, of course, it went to trial. What happened to the lawsuit?
Well, so we had the Markman hearing, and one of the claims was knocked out. The company that bought my company later said, well, that shouldn't have happened. My lawyer made a mistake. I don't know what the truth of the matter is, but so many claims survived that the patent was really fully functional. It was just a minor thing that got knocked out. What happened with the lawsuit was that I decided to sell the company, and the lawsuit and everything surrounding that, all the intellectual property rights, everything went with the company. And I sold to a company called Atmel, A-T-M-E-L, and it was literally one phone call to the CEO.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm coming right over to England. I'll make you an offer you can't refuse.
Is that right?
It was yeah.
Did he look like Marlon Brando?
No. Sorry.
Okay. Okay. So you sold out to Atmel. Why did you want to sell it at that point?
Well, this was in the last quarter of, or last half, I should say, of 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the Apple litigation, we had attracted a lot of interest from other parties that wanted the technologies I mentioned before. So we were doing so much business, and there were so many demands being placed on the company. As an example, Motorola alone wanted a team of 6 of our engineers just to work on Motorola projects. We only had 15 engineers in the whole company.
Oh, really?
And Nokia wanted the same thing, and Samsung wanted the same thing. And
they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it in-house.
No, they didn't have the talent. That which is why Apple ended up with these guys from the University of Delaware.
I see.
Because the talent doesn't exist inside the handset companies. It was outside. It's in academia or in small companies like mine.
Okay.
So all these companies didn't know how to do it. They couldn't just hire people off the street. There was no expertise. It's very specialist. And I was the only guy around who had this knowledge, me and my company, my other engineers.
Okay.
But we didn't have enough engineers. It's really hard to find good engineers, you know? We were in a little village on the south coast of England, and being on the coast means you only have a 180-degree view of the labor pool.
Oh,
so half of the population is already knocked out, and then on top of which, there really weren't any engineering communities down there. It wasn't Silicon Valley exactly, you know?
Well, you could say this of San Francisco, too.
So. Well, no. Yeah, but there are lots and lots of engineers. There was the south coast of England is not Silicon Valley. We were getting engineers in from Bulgaria and other
places. Are you serious?
Yeah, one of my best guys was from Bulgaria, actually. Probably the best guy, to be
really
honest.
Really? Fascinating. Yeah. Okay.
Lubin, if you're listening, you're a genius.
What was his name?
I'm so glad I hired you. Lubin.
Lubin.
Lubin. L-U-B-E-N. Yeah, okay. Lubin. Yeah. Okay. Great guy. Really great guy. Soviet trained, by the way. Anyway, I digress.
So you sold the company to Atmel, and now you're sitting pretty, and it's all Atmel's problem. They're the ones that settled the lawsuit.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And you know what the bottom... What the settlement was?
Yeah, I was never told the actual amount. It was private. It was never published. But my understanding was it was in the low millions. That's all they got out of Apple.
Okay.
The deal, as I understood it, it was that Apple and Atmel shook hands on a proposition where Atmel would continue to sell chips to Apple or would be a supplier to Apple for various handset-related things, so phone-related chips, including touchscreens and stuff.
Yeah.
And Apple, for its part, would also give Atmel some millions, but it was low single-digit millions.
So it was a settlement, but then an agreement for further licensing.
Yeah, but the stupidity of it was this was a handshake agreement.
I see.
And Apple immediately reneged and never bought anything from Atmel other than some flash memories or some cheap stuff.
So all of that is behind you now, and... you're still involved in a few things, but I want to talk to you about some other things. I want to talk to you about in the next podcast about how you're achieving of success. Most young entrepreneurs dream of doing what you're doing, in order to end up with the success that you're enjoying today. And we want to talk about that. And the other thing we want to talk about, especially for the Bradley Center, is the idea that creativity is something computers can't do. And most smart people, and even dumb people, have these kind of epiphanies, these flashes of genius. And I wanted to talk to you about those that you've done. So we'll come back for one more time, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so we've been talking to Hal Philip. We're going to come up with a final podcast. And until you hear that, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.